Lecture 16, The Chinese Revolution.
In this lecture, we'll focus on the 37-year struggle for power between the nationalists and the communists and try to answer the question of why the latter group won the Civil War. In 1911, revolution finished off the centuries-old Chinese empire, but that was the easy part of the process. After a brief euphoria, the country plunged into over a decade of political disorder from about 1911 to 1925, in which central power was simply eclipsed by local warlords who fought each other with their own armies. Out of this vacuum of power emerged the two different political forces which solidified in this 10-year period, the nationalists on the one hand and the communists, each of which, of course, vied to take control over China's destiny. While they joined forces briefly to defeat the local warlords in 1925, in 1926, the country plunged back into civil war when that brief alliance, broke off. And it continued, really, over the rest of the course of the 1920s and 30s until, in 1949, the People's Republic of China is inaugurated, which marks the official end of the civil war. So after the Qing dynasty collapses in February of 1912, the Chinese really spend the next 37 years fighting over what's going to replace it. And the choices were, again, in very basic schematic terms, a Western-inspired liberal government under the nationalists or a communist People's Republic. What we're going to argue in this lecture is that China's two major problems that whatever the new vision of China was going to have to deal with, the two major problems were imperialism and the land question. And that in the end, the communists were able to offer more apparently convincing solutions to these two major problems. And that's what really gives them the advantage in the Civil War. To understand this dynamic, we need to take a close look first at what each side had to offer in terms of its program and its message. The first political alternative emerges during 1911 and was based on the Western liberal model. The leader of this main opposition movement was Sun Yat-sen, who was educated in British Hong Kong and Hawaii, and there absorbed the philosophy of constitutionalism and democratic institutions. So you can see the direct adoption of Western ideas. At the same time, he developed his nationalist fervor through watching China's humiliating treatment by the imperial powers. If you look at his own account of his politicization, he says it was the war with France in 1883 and 84, which really produced in him the inspiration to work for a nationalist revolution. And watching his country having to sign the unequal treaty, watching the Chinese Navy sunk, and so on. So he participated in early nationalist insurrections in Canton in 1895. This was, of course, after the war with Japan, and was a central player in the 1911 revolution. When he dies in 1925, Chiang Kai-shek, who was a military officer in the movement, takes over. So that constitutes the nationalist organization. With some adaptations, this movement, they call themselves the Kuomintang, or the Nationalists, or the GMD, proposed a Western-style democracy on Wilsonian terms, but with a much more intense nationalist component than was present in the Western version. So the three principles of the people, as defined by Sun Yat-sen, were first democracy, by which he meant, if you look at his descriptions, by which he meant basic constitutionalist principles. The second principle was nationalism, and the third principle was economic independence, or what he called livelihood. As he said, quote, "If we do not earnestly espouse nationalism and weld together our 400 million people into a strong nation, there's a danger of China's being lost and our people being destroyed," unquote. Consistent with this kind of absorption of Western political ideals, this movement tended to have a contempt for the Chinese past, for Chinese tradition, which was seen as an obstacle to modernizing along Western lines. An example of this rejection of the past was in the so-called New Culture Movement, that emerges in 1911 and runs parallel to the political revolution. This new culture movement rejected the Confucian past, embraced Western ideals, what it called Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy. Confucius, they argued, had lived in a distant feudal age and that his teachings were totally inappropriate for modern life. Here's one quote from a 1915 New Culture magazine that I think nicely expresses this sentiment. Quote, "Considered in the light of the evolution of human affairs, it is plain that those races that cling to antiquated ways are declining or disappearing day by day, and the people who seek progress and advancement are just beginning to ascend to power and strength. It is possible to predict which of these will survive and which will not. Our people will be turned out of this 20th century world and be lodged in the dark ditches fit only for slaves, cattle, and horses. I would much rather see the past culture of our nation disappear than see our race die out because of its unfitness for living in the modern world." Unquote. If you look at that quote and what it's expressing, there's a very complex version of nationalism that emerges out of that. A nationalism that's both anti-Western, but also Western in values at the same time. So on the one hand, Chinese nationalism becomes a war against the outsider, but on the other hand, it's a war against its own past. This complex set of characteristics set it apart from traditional European nationalism, as it was expressed, for example, in the recent nationalist unifications of Italy and Germany, in which nationalist arguments in those contexts are built on a shared past, that it's precisely the common culture of Italians or Germans that justify unification. But in the colonial world, their shared past was a colonial one. So the traditional authorities, the traditional culture had been defeated and delegitimized by the Western powers. And as I talked about last time in the Chinese context, because a century of imperialist intrusion had destroyed the sense of confidence in Chinese cultural superiority, nationalists felt that the past had to be destroyed if a new Chinese state could compete in a modern world. So we see in this process the creation of a new kind of nationalism that calls for the destruction of the existing social order, not building on that social order, in order to build a new foreign-inspired state that's against the foreign powers. That meant that Chinese nationalism, unlike European nationalism, was not conservative but revolutionary in its implications. It implied a war, again, not just against the foreign powers, but against its own past. And I think it's this sense of mission that gave the GMD, the Kuomintang, much of its political and moral power, as it will in many future third world nationalist movements. So nationalism comes to mean quite a different thing in the third world. So who joined this liberal revolution? Sun Yat-sen was the prototypical nationalist, a member of the radicalized intelligentsia living in those coastal areas, educated abroad, those coastal regions which had had the most interaction with Western culture. It was these booming cultural and economic centers, that is, those economic spheres of influence we talked about last time. These westernized cultural and economic centers, I think, epitomized the contradictions of an imperialism that created economic growth and wealth, as well as a more educated local elite who were exposed to Western political ideas, but of course, which also at the same time created growing resentments among those same elites. So these educated elites become the instigators of the 1911 revolution. Other than this small group, though, that is the kind of Western exposed intelligentsia living in the coastal cities, the problem is that there's not really much of a constituency for this kind of nationalist movement in the rest of China. In other words, we have similar structural problems as existed in the Russian case. where the Russian liberals under Kerensky and his February government, or his February 1917 revolution, were based on really a small portion of the population who were interested in Western constitutional ideals, who were committed to that kind of economic, or excuse me, that kind of political project. The problem was that this Western model of liberalism was derived from a completely different social and economic structure. And people hadn't really begun to think at this point of whether this political system could be adapted to different kinds of economic and social structures. And I think this is a question people are still discussing today, but it hadn't really been raised directly at that point. So while the group's nationalism then was popular with Chinese residents of coastal cities, where Western imperialist influence was directly apparent, it hardly touched the radar of the 80% of the population who were peasants living in the inland regions, most of them who were illiterate, desperately poor, and eking out daily survival working the lands of large landowners. So again, in some ways, similar to the case of the Russian peasantry. Likewise, and again, this is, I think, similar to Russia, the large landowners in the Chinese hinterland were tied to a traditional agrarian economy and to traditional Confucian values. So they also were not really going to be a constituency for this new Western nationalism. So then you have huge inland regions of China that have remained basically untouched by Western influence, untouched by the capitalist and imperialist economy flourishing on the coast, and thus really not responsive to this kind of nationalist and liberal project. Even on the coast, the economically powerful middle class was very small, largely because most of the merchant class were foreigners. So again, middle class tended to be associated with foreigner rather than an indigenous class that could form the basis of a new liberal state. A further difficulty in reaching the majority of the peasants, again as in Russia, because the nationalist movement didn't really have a solution to China's biggest social problem, which was that huge rural class inequity, the fact that the majority of the peasant population are landless and searching for land, while the landlords were, again, kind of extracting all of the surplus without really investing it in economic development. So that the rural economy was really stagnant until some sort of major land reform could be enacted. So while the nationalists, the Kuomintang, offered political democracy and national independence, the peasants, again, were much more interested in something more concrete, getting their own land. The GMD did talk vaguely about land reform, but it didn't really develop a serious plan. In contrast, of course, the communists shared the nationalists' anti-Western nationalism, but they put land reform at the center of their program. Despite the theoretical internationalism of communist theory, communist movements in colonial areas, as I mentioned before, have been fiercely nationalist, and it was really the Chinese communists that are the first to make this link, the first to kind of meld these two forces of communist internationalism and nationalism. So that when you look at Mao's declaration, his speech declaring the establishment of the People's Republic in 1949, he promised that, quote, "Ours will not any longer be a nation subject to insult and humiliation. We have stood up," unquote. So in other words, he was framing it as much a nationalist victory as a class victory. But like the liberal nationalists, the communists had a paradoxical relationship to the West. Instead of borrowing Western liberalism, they borrowed Western communism. The result was a nationalism that was revolutionary, both in its desire to destroy the Chinese past and, of course, in its pursuit of social and economic revolution. And the centerpiece of social revolution became land redistribution. So, again, in very schematic terms, the communist platform addressed both of China's major problems, while the Kuomintang really only addresses one. However, this communist platform does not take shape immediately. It's not something that emerges right away. So we have to go back and explain why communism appears first. The movement doesn't appear until after the First World War, and then why it takes the shape that it does over the course of the 1920s. The turning point that creates the first opening for the communist movement, as it seems to create the opening for so many other things, is again the First World War. And I mentioned this briefly a few lectures back when I was talking about the response of non-Western countries to the terms of the Paris Peace Treaties and their disillusionment at not being treated equally. Concretely, what this meant for China is that despite her participation in the war on the side of the Allies, and she actually sent 200,000 labor battalions to France after 1917, that in China, the German-controlled provinces were not returned to China, but were given to Japan in honor of a secret treaty that had been signed during the war. So, in other words, once again, this was a blatant contradiction to the principle of self-determination. This fact that these provinces had been transferred to Japan in a secret treaty hit the pro-Western Republican movement as a rude awakening. This was China's treatment by Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy. The response to news of the Versailles Treaty and the larger Paris peace treaties hit China on May 1st, 1919, and 3 days later, a mass protest against imperialism, Japan, and the treaty broke out. Known, as I said earlier, as the May 4th movement, it was the first stirring of nationalist mass politics in China. Moreover, many of the disillusioned students and workers who took part in this May 4th movement will participate in the founding of the Communist Party a couple of years later. One of these participants, as I said earlier, was Mao Zedong in his first political action. So it was the perceived betrayal by Western liberal democracies that partly helped turn Mao and the others against liberalism, capitalism, and the Kuomintang. Because as a young man, Mao had begun with vaguely democratic liberal ideals, basically similar to those of Sun Yat-sen. And he also was influenced by the New Culture Movement, rejecting with its calls to reject the Chinese past. But events like the May 4th movement helped make him dissatisfied with liberal nationalism. So in 1920, he began reading Marxist theory, with his first introduction to Marxist theory being the Communist Manifesto that I had mentioned earlier. By the end of the year, he considered himself a Marxist, and in 1921, he helped to found the Chinese Communist Party, which by 1925 had 60,000 members. Quite a small party, if you think of it in terms of the millions of population. In this first phase, up to 1925, Marxism has more weaknesses than strengths in the Chinese Civil War. And I think it's important to point that out, that the communist program that emerges victorious at the end is an evolved one. It's one that adapts over time. That in the initial stages, it didn't seem as if it had that kind of strength. Really, the only major strength in the early 1920s was a theoretical one. That is, Marxist theory was able to link and explain the two main problems of imperialism and rural poverty. Lenin had formulated a theory about imperialism that linked poverty in the non-Western world with the capitalist exploitation of the West. So the basic argument of Lenin's book was that capitalism required larger and larger markets to sell its goods and increase its profits, and that this is what fueled imperialism. But it also argued that imperialist countries were able to keep their own populations happy and increase the living standards of its own populations by squeezing poorer countries. So this the so-called economic imperialist argument. So this argument really appealed to many Chinese intellectuals because it was a neat linkage between the problem of rural poverty and imperialism. It explained how imperialism was impoverishing China. To counter this strength, though, the weakness of Marxism in China was similar to that in Russia, which is that since Marxist theory envisioned a developed industrial economy and a major role for the industrial working class, China didn't have either of those things. It was the working class and the cities, the urban areas, were only a very small part of the population. Now, we talked about how in the Soviet Union, Lenin acknowledged and recognized this problem as well. And he was the first to say that the communists had to pay attention to the peasants and include them in the revolution. But even in the Russian Revolution, it was led and orchestrated by the workers in St. Petersburg and Moscow, in the major cities, with the peasants in a supporting role. So it still was led by the workers. And the fact that Russia, even though it was not an industrialized country, it had those two or three major industrial centers because of its recent state-initiated industrialization. It had those centers from which a revolution could be launched and organized. But China didn't even have that minimal level of industrialization. And nevertheless, the Communist Party began by following the Soviet model. So in the first years, in the early 1920s, it spent most of its energy organizing students and workers in those coastal cities, following the Russian experience and following the Russian model of trying to form that vanguard party among the urban working classes. This phase of urban organization culminated with a wave of social revolutionary movements, which were both anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist in 1925-1926. In other words, they were strikes and rebellions that were directed against the bosses who were both foreigners and capitalists at the same time. This revolutionary movement, however, causes the GMD to break its alliance with the communists and to turn against the communists rather than allying with them. And partly because of the small size and isolation of the urban population, it was very easy for the GMD to crush the Communist Party, this incipient movement. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed in a campaign to exterminate the Communist Party. And the upshot was that essentially the urban working class Communist Party was crushed permanently by 1927. So what happens then? After 1927, the Communist Party was forced to adopt a new strategy if it wanted to survive. What the destruction of the working class base and the working class movement forced the party to do was to really take the peasants seriously, not just in a supporting role. The remnants of the Communist Party who had escaped the repression in their urban bases hid in remote rural areas, hoping to escape the nationalist armies. And it was there that they began experimenting with organizing the peasants. One of the foremost supporters of this new strategy was Mao, who from the mid-1920s had become the party's peasant expert, in essence. And after 1926, he was literally the director of the peasant department. So in the years after 1927, the communists built rural strongholds based on a radical land redistribution policy and local forms of self-government, which gained the support of peasants. By the early 1930s, the Communist Party had established a dozen of these local people's republics in remote rural areas, which again kept them out of the way of the nationalist government, which encompassed 3 to 4 million people over these 12 republics. Again, still a minority if you think of a population of 450 million, but this was the core of communist support and their new project. So the party really gains genuine popular support because of this at least embodiment of a solution to China's rural agrarian problem or its poverty problem. These rural experiments give the communists a significant popular following, but they still wouldn't have been enough to seize power. Having some isolated rural outposts in the middle of nowhere was not going to allow them to seize power. Even with their popular support, the communists were on the verge of extinction by the mid-1930s. What happens is that in 1934, the nationalist armies finally decide to go after those rural strongholds and finally drive Mao and the Communist Party out of their central stronghold in the Shaanxi province and destroy, essentially, these People's Republics. At this point, the retreating Communist Army began what became known as the Long March, walking 6,000 miles to the even more distant northwest province of Yunnan, where they hoped to be out of reach of the nationalists. The Long March began with 100,000 men and 35 women, but after over a year of course, hardship and heroism that becomes part of the communist mythology, that 100,000 had been reduced to 8,000. Thus, if you look in terms of power politics and in the likelihood of the communists taking over the state at that point, you would have to think that that likelihood would be almost down to zero. They seem to be back to square one. This is not entirely true because the Long March, while it didn't give them any power, it did create a good deal of sympathy. You know, they were walked across half of China, and there was a good deal of sympathy, a greater audience created for their ideas. Nevertheless, sympathy for their social platform was not going to be enough to win a civil war. What shifts the balance of power once again is the Japanese invasion of China in 1937. Both the communists and the nationalists had a strong anti-imperialist rhetoric, but during the Japanese invasion, it's actually the communists who are able to organize the most successful resistance to the Japanese, which turned them into nationalist heroes over the course of the Pacific War. What the Communist Party was able to do was to use the guerrilla tactics that it had been using against the nationalist armies that it had perfected for so many years. They were able to turn these guerrilla tactics against the superior force of the Japanese army. And that, in a sense, was the only way that the Japanese army could be resisted. The problem that the nationalist armies faced was that they were regular armies that were clearly inferior to the Japanese forces, and what they tended to do was withdraw and not confront the Japanese armies directly, partly because it would have been military suicide to put themselves in the field against such a superior military force. But that what that created was the illusion that the communists were the better nationalist fighters. And what made this kind of transformation in nationalist thinking even worse, after 1940, a worried Kuomintang nationalist movement begins to put their armies into action against the communists rather than against the Japanese. And of course, since the communists seem to be mounting the only effective resistance against the Japanese, this further delegitimizes the nationalist anti-imperialist standing of the Kuomintang. As a result of this image of the communists as nationalist heroes, the Red Army, which of course had dwindled to 8,000 at the end of the Long March, balloons to an enormous volunteer army of 1 million men by the end of the war, a disciplined army that gained respect through resisting the foreign invader. And thus, in 1947, Mao could talk about China standing up for itself and the communists being a central player in that. In contrast, the Kuomintang lost much of the prestige that it had gained as an anti-imperialist nationalist movement through its low profile against the Japanese. In other words, then, by the end of the war, the communists had demonstrated that it had a plan to solve China's two major problems. It had demonstrated its anti-imperialist credentials in the war against Japan, and of course it had demonstrated its plan to solve the social problems through its earlier People's Republics. In doing this, China, of course, provides a powerful model of revolutionary nationalism based on Western communism, but adapted in such a way that the least developed rather than the most developed countries could use it. Thus, Maoism is taken up in the later 20th century by a variety of poor agrarian countries like Cuba, Angola, Vietnam, which launched similar revolutionary peasant nationalist movements. While once again, all of these revolutions end up enslaving the very peasants that they promised to liberate, we can't understand the enthusiasm with which this model is taken up unless we go back to the origins and understand the attraction in the initial stages.